support for this KQED podcast comes from ACT, presenting Stephen Sondheim's rapturous musical, A Little Night Music. Featuring an all-star cast, A Little Night Music begins performances at ACT's Geary Theater May 20th. ACT-SF.org.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on the Forum program this morning, actor Peter Coyote has lived many lives. He grew up wealthy in New York and went on to become a prominent figure in San Francisco's counterculture scene of the 60s. In his new memoir, The Rain Man's Third Cure, the longtime Marin resident reflects on the many influences in his life, from his violent father to a mafia consigliere to poet Gary Snyder. Join us for Forum. It's next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. Hippie commune resident and counterculture political activist Peter Coyote was born into a well-to-do New York family named Cajon and has lived many lives, mostly here in the Bay Area, since then and since his days as a member of the Mime Troupe and a Jerry Brown California Arts Council appointee. Now an ordained Zen priest, he has acted in over 140 films and television shows, done seemingly countless voiceover narrations, and won an Emmy for one of them, The Pacific Century. He's also a writer, having long ago earned a Pushcart Award for fiction and published two highly personal memoirs, Sleeping Where I Fall, which we featured on Forum, and most recently, The Rain Man's Third Cure. He joins us in studio for this Forum Hour. Good to have you back.
Well, it's nice to be back, and I consider us such good friends. I'm shocked that you applied two words to me that I would never apply to myself. One was hippie, and the other was activist.
And why wouldn't you apply those words?
Well, hippie was a made-up word that was designed to diminish the next generation of kind of beatnik hipsters and infantilize us. It was a Herb Cain coinage. And we didn't call ourselves hippies. We called ourselves maybe hipsters or, you know, just human beings. But activist is a more pernicious word that I never use because if you want to separate someone from the broad mass of humanity, you add an IST after them. You make them a socialist, a communist, an environmentalist, an activist. And the implication is that most people never act on their beliefs
at all. A linguist?
Yeah. That's normal. And that there's some small radicalized subset of people who actually engage with their lives. And I turn that around. And my feeling is, if you're not engaged with your own beliefs, you're a hypocrite. So I'll call myself engaged, but not an activist.
You're giving me a semantic lesson I never expected, especially with a word like pernicious, because I considered myself an activist and a hippie, but so we go.
You're much more than that, Michael.
Well, let's – no, I considered. I use the past tense here. But let's go to another maybe semantic distinction between memoir and fiction, because you've written both, and the last two volumes have been memoir. And certainly you can't necessarily let your imagination go, or can you, when you write a memoir? I mean, you're depending more, one would argue, on recall and summoning up the memories, which may be fictional or may be amended or conflated, etc. But it's a whole different schema, isn't it?
Well, it's interesting. First of all, the Carla's story that I won the Pushcart Prize for was not fiction. It was an original chapter in Sleeping Where I Fall, but it sort of didn't have a place. But still, the question you ask is really germane. And there are some people that would suggest that even biography is fiction because you're looking at reality through a lens, you're selecting. You're following either a stated or an unstated thesis and a goal, and you're describing it in language. And the pungency of that language and the vividness of it and the emotion that you attach to it are all elements of fiction and all elements of the craft of writing. So although it's fact-based, those facts are focused through a lens.
You've got some really fine writing here, let me say, in both of your books. But what you've pulled together here is also almost what one could argue is exposition in a way, because you're saying this is my life and you're putting it out there and you're writing about very personal kinds of things, which is usually different than fiction, even though Romana Clay's and things like that can just be another form of autobiography. But the title, and let's get right to it here, The Rain Man's Third Cure, an irregular education subtitle, is really taken from Bob Dylan lyrics that seem to be about power and love for you, at least, in your interpretation. And you're looking in this book for a third way. And you're really, in a sense, almost giving this as a little bit of a homily about how that third way worked for you and could work for others. It's the spiritual way, the way of wisdom.
This is why I love to be on this show. That's it, in a nutshell. I would say that it's not as if the worlds of love and power didn't work for me. I thought those were the only options for a long time, and I was not as successful at either love or power as I thought people around me were. Certainly, I was not as successful at power as my father was, but from watching his life, he was a very, very wealthy man, and he lost it all. And in the intervening period, I never went to a baseball game with him. I never spent 24 hours with him. I just watched him drive himself to make money. And no one in my house really was very happy. And it saved me a great deal of effort later in life, because I learned pretty early on that you were never going to get rich enough to be happy, that was a separate condition. So when being a movie actor and, opening the Cannes Film Festival and all of those things, all of those triumphs didn't put some internal unease at rest, some itch. It didn't bandage me where I was wounded. I had to start to look more deeply at this third path, which I was introduced to through Buddhism.
But I would submit to you, you were also looking for a surrogate father all along. You found it, in fact, in a man you called an uncle, who was a consigliere, who was really, in many ways, a thug in some respects. I mean, he worked for Frank Costello, and he was a tough guy.
He was
a
partner with Frank Costello.
Well, I shouldn't say work for, yeah. And he was one hell of a tough guy, just from the way you draw him. And you draw quite a full-dimensional portrait of him. But, I mean, Gary Snyder, you felt uncomfortable maybe calling a father figure, but in some ways he helped give birth to this third path of yours.
Well, the word that I've chosen to use is mentors. You're exactly right in the sense that When a child grows up with an unstable or a volatile parent,
or even a neglectful parent,
you can't really make yourself out of them. And traditional psychological wisdom states that you begin to look at adults around you in the world and begin to take characteristics that you like or that you feel you need. And that's certainly what I did. And the great irony of my dad's inability to parent me was his ability to present me with these fabulous teachers who really gave me in-depth educations in a way that short-circuited all the Oedipal nonsense of having to deal with a father. So there was a real silver lining to that cloud.
Talking to Peter Coyote, his new memoir is The Rain Man's Third Cure, an Irregular Education. And actually, I want to go back over your life and many of the things you write about here, but a key in this book is the 7-day session you went through where you had that moment of, well, I don't know if it was Sartori or enlightenment or certainly something that was ineffable, something that was transcendent. I remember Jack Kornfield's book, After the Ecstasy, the Laundry. I mean, you have to go back to living the regular life. But
yeah.
But that you did have a transformative experience.
Well, I did. And as I say in the book, and then the next thing I realized was it wasn't all that important. When I started Zen practice, when I first started reading about Zen, at 14 and 15, I read about this idea of enlightenment, and man, that's what I wanted. I wanted to be the smartest guy in the room. I wanted to know the answers to everything. I figured I would get the best women. Everything would come to me. And the daily practice of Zen and monastic ritual just drives that out of you. And at a certain point, you have to give that up, because if you're sitting for enlightenment, you're never going to get it. you've created a self and you've created enlightenment as two separate concepts, and it doesn't happen. And the real point is that if you have this experience, it just codifies an intuition you've had your entire life. The minute you get up off your pillow, you are charged to be a human being. And you don't have to wait for enlightenment to start being kind and compassionate and helpful to others. And as a matter of fact, standard Buddhist doctrine would say there is no enlightenment outside of daily practice.
Well, you want to clearly be of service, particularly now that you are not only an ordained Zen priest, but maybe on your way to being a Zen master, and you've been working with teachers and so forth. And in fact, I believe you talked about wanting to make Zen practice part of a regular vernacular, like with mechanics and police officers and so forth. And some would say, that's east is east, west is west, and never the twain, or something along those lines. But you believe you can bring it into everyday common parlance?
Well, my teacher and I call it the thousand-year project. But yes, I do. If you look at the history of Buddhism, it began in a Hindu culture in India and was affected by Hindu values and Hindu, you know, the milieu where it grew up. And then it went to China, and it mixed with Confucianism and became Chan. It went to Japan. It mixed with Shinto and nature worship and became Zen. It went to Tibet and mixed with Bon shamanism and became Nyingman, Gelugpa, and Gelugpa. So it's always been transformed, as we'd expect. And I think one of the things that we might find is that we're going to discover that the compassion of the West may actually be psychology, or it may be social justice. And I think that Buddhism is being affected by both. What I mean by vernacular is, although my teacher was Japanese and my lineage is Japanese and I wear big robes and I light incense and do all these things when it's appropriate, if I don't have to talk to you about Zen to be helpful, why should I? Just if you take a canoe across a lake and you get to the other side, you don't have to keep carrying the boat with you. So I'm actually...
That sounds very Zen, by the way.
Well, it's pretty good. I'm meeting a police sergeant tomorrow to talk about bringing some stuff to the city prison to be helpful to the police, to the convicts, to the people there. And I can't go in talking a lot of Hindu shvindu stuff. I've got to be as real as a dirty nickel. And my effort is to be able to do that, to be able to talk about these states of mind and the way we think about ourselves in everyday idiomatic English.
There's a play by Carol Churchill called Owners. I don't know if you know it. But
called
she,
what?
Owners.
No,
I believe that's a play. But she's kind of parodying and maybe even satirizing a bit certain Zen stances and so forth. There's a Buddhist young man in this. His house is on fire and... children are in there and everything. He says, I'm just not going to do anything. There's no need in acting or in you know, it doesn't in the grand schema, it doesn't mean anything to act. And, you know, here you are, though it may be a pernicious word, active, let's just say, as opposed to activist, doing things, going to jails and so forth, trying to serve in so many different ways, in so many different capacities. In fact, when you came in, you said, can I talk about the banks? I heard your segment this morning on the banks. I'd like to hear what you have to say about this, but in terms of practice and meditation and becoming one with everything, like the old joke with the hot dog vendor, do you really need to be active? Do you need to be political? That's more the 60s counterculture stuff than it is Zen, isn't it?
No, you absolutely need to be active and make an effort, because you may be one with everything when you're on your pillow. But as soon as you stand up, you fall back into this discrete reality where you're separate from me and every snowflake and every blade of grass is different. And our everyday experience is in an imperfect, always changing world. And the only way we can manifest our experience of the unchanging and the absolute is by effort, is by struggling against our habits, by struggling against our impulses, by making an effort in this everyday human life. And that's the part that most people misunderstand. They think everything is Zen. It's all one. Let's have a drink, you know. Let's sleep with the dog.
No, but it's not. If you read the Buddha and you have very assiduously, you realize how important kindness is, how important service is, and compassion and mindfulness in every way, being a better human being.
And even though we know that we're all interconnected, that you and I have never been separate from oxygen or sunlight or microbes in the soil that grow our food or pollinating insects, still our experience brought to us by our five senses is of a separate self. And balancing both of those so that we don't favor one or the other is the facility that meditating gives you. It makes the membrane between them kind of porous. So while I'm looking at you as a separate person, I'm not forgetting that we have the same common denominator.
And what about all those past selves, those former incarnates? You've had many of them, former avatars. They're indispensable to who you are now, and they're not to be forgotten?
I don't know. I don't know what to say about that, because I was always just doing something that interested me in the present moment. I didn't have a game plan. I'd be much richer in my retirement if I had. I just was...
Well, if you could have endured L.A. too.
I was just rather indulgent about thinking, wow, I'm interested in this, and I want to learn about this. And up until I was about 40, it just seemed that everything I was interested in interested other people, and the knowledge that I gained in my own studies facilitated a certain amount of social currency. And then in my 40s sometimes, I sort of dropped off the edge, and now I look at the magazines and the checkout stands. I don't know who the people are.
It's almost comforting, I imagine.
Yeah.
What about when you consider all of the drugs you took? In fact, I even said on the air once, because I was in the middle of reading your book, I said it's astonishing just the volume, the quantity of drugs that you took into your system. there are many people who would not have a mind like you have, and I mean that with all due respect. And you've suffered hepatitis C. This is no secret to people who followed your life, and you've been open about it and public about it. I hope you're healthy now.
Since February 1st, I've been virus-free.
Wonderful.
And I've passed three post-treatment blood tests, and I'm still virus-free.
No, that's great news. But would you have rather done without the drugs?
Yes. There were a lot of reasons for the taking of the drugs. One were unresolved issues of self-esteem and pain and suffering about my home. Part of it was an honest intellectual challenge that when the diggers were trying to imagine a new world and make it real by acting it out, the question occurs to you, well, suppose my imagination has already been tamed. Suppose I'm just imagining within the playpen that I'm allowed to do. And so drugs seemed, especially hard and really illicit drugs, seemed like a way that the society would never condone. So it sort of justified my experiment there.
So you're being rebellious and transgressive when you look back on it, in large part against conformity and all those kinds of things?
Well, absolutely. I didn't really have an idea of what freedom actually was. I thought freedom was just economic, or freedom was just political. So I had a young man's understanding, an adolescent understanding. But what I didn't understand is that I only have this one body. And anything I do to it that diminishes its capacity or threatens it is not helping anyone. How could anyone treat me as a serious environmentalist if I was destroying my own body? It's like as soon as I see somebody smoking and they talk to me about pollution, I laugh. I can't take them seriously. So yes, I regret that. I regret having done those drugs. And more pertinently, I regret the fact that I set a bad example to some younger people that never made it, that died before they were 25, looking up to me and admiring me. And even though I never actually gave them drugs, I didn't take responsibility for knowing that they were looking up to me and thinking that whatever it was they admired about me was part and parcel of my behavior with drugs.
So your ownership of that kind of responsibility, does it bring guilt?
I'm not sure. It brings resolve. the guilt is long gone. I mean, the only thing I can do now, I'm in this moment. So my resolve is to remember that, to remember that I cost people their lives in some cases. I caused damage to other people who are still living by my behavior. And it gives me a resolve to realize that as a human being, I have the capacity to be anything any other human being can be. I can be Hitler. I can be Mother Teresa. And not knowing that is what makes certain kinds of unconscious behavior possible. When we call ourselves the good guys, and ipso facto, everything we do is good, you only have to look at the Middle East to see the fruits of that. But if I say, I'm a human being, I can be incredibly dangerous if I'm not monitored, it encourages me to monitor my behavior. And when I see anger or jealousy or resentment or any of those negative capacities coming up to the surface, I can nip them in the bud because I'm looking for them.
You were correcting me on activist and hippie. I might just a little. Christopher Hitchens has written about Mother Teresa. You might want to read what he has to say about her, and you might using her as a
good call. Yeah. Well, His Holiness, the Dalai Lama.
I think that's safer,
yeah,
perhaps.
Thank you.
We're coming up on a break here. What did you want to say about the banks?
I wanted to say that there are two hinges available to us as people. One hinge is the vote. That even though the banks have bought Congress, the Congress members need the vote to get in. And the other hinge is the law. And everyone thinks that the banks are bulletproof because they own the lawmakers. But my curiosity is piqued by the fact, I wonder if everyone just stopped buying as a political protest, bought no more than they needed, 2 gallons of gasoline, just enough groceries for the week, no new clothes, no new toys, no new nothing. Because I think that any kind of resistance to this is going to have to come from the people, the masses of people, because the followers in Congress who follow polls, they're never going to lead us. They're bought. They're owned. We live in a corporatocracy. But we still have the power to slow this whole mechanism down just by controlling our own greed. That's what makes us the same as the banks. That's what keeps the whole thing going. Every time we get an impulse, we feel bad, we buy something new. If we just tried for a month to just buy as little as you possibly could, I think it would send ripples through the entire economy.
Boy, tell that to a shopaholic, for example.
Well, you know, try saying don't take drugs to an addict.
Yeah, exactly. They run along parallel lines. Again, our guest this hour is Peter Coyote. The Rain Man's Third Cure is his new book, An Irregular Education. And he's had quite a life, and it's all embedded in these two volumes. And he certainly has been known throughout the Bay Area for many years as well. And you may want to join us with our conversation here, which is ranging as it usually does when Peter is a guest on the program. You may have questions or you may have responses, and we indeed welcome your interacting in the program. Our toll-free number, you can go and join us now, is 866-733-6786. Again, that's toll-free, 866-733-6786. Or you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or post questions or comments onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @KQEDForum. And of all the avatars, of all the incarnations that Peter Coyote has had, I just want to get on the record, he is now a grandfather, and says that being a grandfather is as good as sex was when you were 20 years old.
Yeah.
Great line. More when we return on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Peter Coyote, who has had many lives. And his book, The Rain Man's Third Cure, An Irregular Education, is really, as I said earlier, in many respects, not only about his life, but about his life in terms of understanding perhaps what we could call deeper truths and more spiritual truths and ways to wisdom after all he's been through. And he's been through a lot, and it's a pretty remarkable life and a fascinating one to read about. But there are deeper issues that he's concerned with in the book. And I wanted to pretty much bring that into focus here when I first talked about the title. Here's an online comment from Ben. It says, years ago, your guest narrated Carlos Castaneda's works. Did your guest just do this as a job, or did he believe in some of the ideas?
No, Carlos Castaneda's books were critically formative to me for a long time. And it was a surprise to find out that they were even used at Tassajara Monastery. They were some of the few non-Zen books that were available there. And I actually met Carlos, and I thought it was going to be the fulfillment of a lifelong desire to study with him. But he died after I'd done the second book. And there's a long story, I don't know if I told it, about having to give up lucid dreaming because I didn't have a teacher, and I got on a cusp that I was afraid to cross.
But you did do peyote and all that drug taking.
Oh, yeah. I did a lot of peyote, and I still have peyote plants on my altar. But I think that people say all sorts of stuff, like it's a fake, it's a this and that, but I don't believe that. It's the experiences are too reminiscent of deep experiences I've had in meditating. And there's too much of a schema and a system there, and there's too much that you can actually replicate and discover on your own by practicing the practices in those books. So I remain a fan of them.
Another listener says, wow, how timely. I'm currently reading Emmett Grogan's 1972 biography, Ring of Livio. He makes several references to Peter Coyote and their time together here in San Francisco in the 60s. Can Mr. Coyote take us back a little to his days with Grogan as part of the Digger and Mime groups and his impressions of the man, Grogan?
Yeah, well, there's. I wrote a foreword to Ring of Livio. I don't know what edition he has, but it was a chapter from Sleeping Where I Fall. And Emmett was a very charismatic, very brilliant, very fluid guy, but he didn't change with the times, and he had a persona that was completely appropriate to a window of time when the counterculture was up and running and was fascinating to the majority culture, but that moment left, and he didn't change with it, and it worried him, and it made him feel left behind, and he didn't want to give up enough of his celebrity to disappear for a number of years and woodshed and come up with a new appropriate skill. But he certainly influenced my life more than anybody I had met up till then, and certainly more than I would allow anyone to do ever since.
You continue to be mainly known, of course, for all the acting you've done. I don't know if people realize that you were in a movie called Revenge of the Zombies 4 in Romania, but...
Thanks, Michael.
No, I mean, you've done a whole range of movies. You even played a character named Krasny in a script that Esterhaz did.
Well, that's how we met, wasn't it?
I think it was, yeah. Jagged Edge, but... I suppose most people know you for E.T. The story was that Spielberg... who made about $300 million in that, gave you $10,000 afterward, but you were, paid about $38 for making...
$28,
excuse me. Okay, it was close to the figure. But what people don't know about all these avatars of yours is that you're also a guitar player. You're a serious poet, aspiring poet. You're also a singer. I mean, you know, a man of many colors, as was said about Prince Hal. And someone who is very accomplished, particularly in the world of... narrative and voices. I mean, you know, it just knocks me out how well you are at taking a script, because, you know, I've done this sort of work off and on, and it's hard. I mean, it's hard to project your voice, even if you've got a voice and you like your pipes and you like to work with your voice, but you do it almost in a mystical way. I think you've even written about this and talked about it. You do it almost like a jazz improvisationist.
Well, that's true. You know, there was I just came from New York, where Ken Burns and I have done the first half of his next series on Vietnam, which is going to be earth-shattering. It's going to be extraordinary. Stuff that's going to be revealed in interviews with American and Vietnamese soldiers in the same battles, and the absolute unpreparedness of our leaders in their thinking, in their study of the culture. And when you meet the Vietnamese generals and you see that they were never going to lose, they were prepared to pay any cost to have their country. you realize that it's completely referential to the Middle East. And it's another coup for Ken Burns, as far as I'm concerned. But when we first met, there was a funny story because he wanted me to do the national parks. And he came prepared with bundles of scripts and DVDs, and I could watch the movies and packs of pencils. And I said, well, no, you know, I just do it in the studio. And he blanched, and he said, what do you mean? I said, well, I just look at it when I get in the studio and I read it. And he said, well, that won't work. You don't know how impeccable I am. And I must have had a double dose of brat juice for breakfast because I said, well, you don't know how good I am. And there was a little face-off, and he said, well, okay, I'll book a studio for a month and we'll do it. And I said, no, you don't have to. There's 9 episodes. We'll do an episode and a half a day. And we did. And, you know, 7 shows later, I'm still working with him, and we get along famously.
You know, he is, and I'll say this publicly, he is a good friend. I mean, if you are a friend of his.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they had a book party for me way back in the day when I published a book with Stanford called Off Mic. And Ken came down from New Hampshire. This is in New York. I mean,
how touching.
It touches me to this day. And yeah. It also, again, reveals that this is a guy who, if he considers you his friend, he will go to bat for you any way he can.
He's an astounding person, really. He is one of the most impeccable craftsmen I've ever seen in any milieu. And he pays more fastidious attention to every detail of what he's doing. We even have the only place we ever quibble, and it's just good humored by now, is about music. Like, you and I are Jews, Michael, so we're minor key people. So when I make a list and I'm reading something, and I'll say, there was a microphone stand, there was a computer, there were Michael's headphones and my book, he'll go, no, no. There was a microphone stand, a computer, a headphone, and Peter's book. He wants always a dropping tone on lists. So I'll read 2 pages of incredibly complex prose, and he'll say, in line 17, you went up on butt.
You know, that's fascinating, too, because Raul Ramirez, whom I revered and loved deeply, who was our executive producer for many years, brought in a guy who had done a lot of work at NPR with people working on voices. And I admit I was a little skeptical about this kind of tutoring and everything. I do what I do, and I do it naturally, and, you know, that's how I like to do it. But he always talked about bringing your voice up. You know, you have to bring your voice up. And here you're talking about Ken just from the antithesis.
I never listen to those guys. When people tell me they're taking voiceover lessons, I always begin by saying don't. Because the trick is, if you're trying to be someone other than yourself, that part is filled. Whoever you're imitating, whoever you'd like to be, there's somebody who's that
They've
guy.
Got the niche.
Yeah, they've got the niche.
Let me get a caller on here. James, join us. Hi. James is calling from Sonoma, by the way, and you're going to have Peter as a resident up there pretty
neighbor.
Soon.
That's fantastic, because I'm actually an expat New Yorker and a Broadway actor. So welcome to the neighborhood, Peter.
Hi, James. Thanks.
Huge fan of your work both on stage and off. And I just have a question as a mindfulness practitioner myself. If you could talk about the parallels or analogs in acting, about being present in the present tense moment, as well as in a Zen practice, what your experience with that has been.
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. It's not actually a question, but dead air time. I'm just trying to think about the best way to talk about it, because Michael also mentioned something earlier that I wanted to bring mindfulness up about. Anyway, the wonderful thing about, I know what it was. So in acting, there is a truism that the more specific the picture is that you have in your imagination, the more, like if you're imagining a scene and you're imagining you're playing it with your mother, it will be a very different and much more appreciable scene to the audience than if you're just trying to play sadness or if you're trying to play an emotion.
You're talking about visualization then?
Specificity of the internal images that you're working with. And so what happens is, when we see good actors, we understand them universally, even though their image is very, very particular and personal. There's a correlation. And it's the vividness with which they bring the image they're working with, or what the food that they've given their imagination to make it bloom, that actually reaches out to us. So to me, the great constant between sitting and acting was, it was a lovely exercise to be able to go to ground zero every day and let the self fall away. And especially when I was kind of working on a role, because working on a role is invoking a role. You're invoking a character all the time. You're summoning them up. And it's oftentimes why a lot of actors behave badly, because they've been acting like a heinous killer for 6 hours, and then they call lunch and they scream at the girl who doesn't bring them their coffee. Well, we're supposed to know better. But it is an invocation, and it does lay with you.
Does that invocation mean Stanislavski? Is that what you're
talking about? No, I mean really like invoking. You're calling some aspect of yourself to the fore. I've never killed anyone, but I've swatted a fly. And so if I point a gun at you and pull the trigger like I was swatting a fly, it makes me look like the most cold-blooded and heartless person imaginable. If I point a gun at you and pull the trigger as if I was afraid it was going to go off, I'm not going to look like a seasoned mafia killer. So the parallel that James is talking about, for me anyway, when you're acting, you're always in the moment. You don't know what the next moment's going to be. And the greatest actors are the ones who will take the greatest risk of waiting until their opposite number or their intuition delivers them something real. And in Zazen, we're just watching these moments. We're tracking our breath. The mind is intruding. Images, stuff comes from deep in dream states. And when you're invoking a character as an actor, many times those dream states will bring gold to the fore that you can use off your pillow.
Did you do a dream state, for example, when you played Harvey Milk?
No.
Or how did you invoke Harvey Milk?
Oh, I don't know. That was yesterday. I saw footage of him. I remembered him from public utterance. I was working for Jerry Brown at that time. And I just began to sort of feel my way into his skin. That's an invocation.
And we'll invoke another caller here. We'll bring Henry into the conversation. Henry, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for bringing meditation to the jail. That's really admirable, and I can't think of anything more, valuable.
I hope you're not there.
Sorry?
I hope you're not in.
No, I don't think so, as far as I know. But then also, I want to thank you for your exposition of the interplay between cosmic unity and individual, action and pathos. The Suzuki Roshi's one-liner, not two, not one. I really
like to
fall back on that. And finally, your biography and your current state just somehow made me think of the line from the Bob Dylan song, I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now. So thank you.
Okay.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you for that call. And again, you can join us with Peter Coyote at 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org. Here's an email from Lois, from Livermore, who writes, as a child of the 60s experience, I am so disappointed in my generation. I was sure we were going to change the world. Nothing has changed, and maybe it's worse. You've said... You've talked about the failure of the generation. I mean, in terms of stamping out racism and, you've even mentioned free market capitalism, things that you felt were necessary to fight against imperialism. And you've said you see those as failures.
Well, I think that it's fair to say that we failed on most of our political agendas. And those were the lists that you ran down. We didn't stop war. We didn't stop free market capitalism. We didn't stop racism. We didn't stop a whole host of political issues. But we can take a lot of credit for having really moved the dial on every single cultural issue. There's no place in the United States where you can go today where there's not a women's movement, an environmental movement, where you can't find organic food, slow food, local food, where you can't find alternative spiritual practices, Vipassana, Buddhism, Hinduism, Tibetan Buddhism, Chan Buddhism, where you can't find alternative medical practices, acupuncture, naturopathy, homeopathy. And if you look at these things, these are culture. And culture to me is much, much deeper than politics. You now have farmers in conservative Nebraska who are fighting the fracking to protect their water. And so people who care about their food and care about their water and care about their bodies are going to be much more observant about the environment and how it's taken care of.
It's actually been said on this program that maybe the real revolution came from Berkeley more from Alice Waters than perhaps anybody else.
And well, Alice came directly out of politics, and she was one of the first people to understand that culture trumped politics, and so were the diggers. The diggers were not, you know, SDS, socialist, Marxist, analysts. We were imagining a culture in which we could be authentic people and trying to make it real by acting it out. Where we were deficient was in our projection of how much time would be required.
The question about the diggers from Ben, one of our listeners, says, the diggers fed people in Golden Gate Park's panhandle. What happened with that program? Was it continued?
Well, it was continued. We did it for about 3 years. But a lot of us began to feel that we had higher aspirations than running a soup kitchen for America's runaways. So that job was taken over by a lot of churches. Even at the time, we were helped by churches in the Haight-Ashbury. And we wanted to put our energy into creating an alternative economy, a counterculture. And I think it was a mistake to have done that. Not that I would have stayed running a soup kitchen forever, but it was just to demonstrate the lie that the city was putting forward, that they didn't have the money, they didn't have the this or the that to help people. We started the free store. We set the prototype for the first medical clinic. We had free crash pads. We had free food, basically to say, if you want to do it, just get out and do it. You can do it. There are no excuses.
I was going to ask you about how you came, well, from that whole period of your life to actually be appointed by then-Governor Brown, now Governor Brown, Governor Brown in his first incarnation, gubernatorial incarnation, to the Arts Council. Did you know Jerry Brown at that point? Or?
No, I didn't. I was actually, the secret ingredient was that I knew Gary Snyder. And Gary won the Pulitzer Prize in 1975, and the governor appointed him to create an arts council. And Gary wanted to do all working artists. And I was working on a $600 a month gig as a CETA artist. I was one of the 100 people that was hired out of the thousands that showed up. And Gary and I had been political comrades, and we'd had a lot of discussions. And he invited me to joined the council with him, and I first turned him down. I said, I'm not going to go to work for the state. And then he got me. He said, well, it would give you an opportunity to define the state, wouldn't it? And I did it, and it turned out to be something I was really gifted at. I was elected chairman the next year after Gary, and I served for 4 years until the legislature passed a law preventing me from being chairman again because I was a big pain in the ass. But I'm very proud of the work that we did there. We raised the budget from $1 to $16 million a year, and we had programs with 14 departments of state who were picking up half the cost. We were making films on teenage pregnancy with high school kids that were being co-paid for by Department of Education. We had dancers working with senior citizens. So we were working with all these agencies that would never be cut, and using artists as a great reservoir of creative problem solvers in the state to sort of save the behinds of many of these agencies that were not solving the problems they were tasked with solving for the taxpayer.
Still a source of pride for you.
Yeah.
And as well it should be. But the regret about drugs, I was always wondering, Snyder didn't use any drugs that I know of. He was pretty antipathetic to them, wasn't he?
Yeah, well, Gary is a sober man. And that was one of the things that impressed me about him, is that every place that I looked at his life, it was developed to the level of everything else. So he didn't play favorites. His family relationships were as sound as his artistic work. His carpentry work was as sound as his community political work. And I had never seen anybody that was that 360-degree around. And I was fascinated by that, and I took that as kind of a personal challenge. And when I discovered that Buddhism might have had something to do with it, it induced me to get serious about practicing.
And about being like Gary Snyder has been a scholar, really. I mean, you have to be a scholar, don't you, to really understand and fully appreciate the paths that you're on?
Well, I don't know. I'm not really a very good scholar. Gary is actually a scholar. I tell the story in my book. One day we were having a conversation. We were cutting wood, and he
Which
was
is one of his most famous poems, of course.
Yeah, axe handles.
Axe handles.
So, but we were cutting wood, and his conversation was ranging across 8 centuries of Buddhism and multiple cultures and things like that. And I got frustrated. I said, "Gary, how the hell do you know all that?" And he said, "I'll show you." And he took me into this room where there was a massive library card catalog, and in it were these organized cards: Buddhism, Asian, Aleutian, this one, that one, that one, and all indexed to his journals.
It's amazing just the voluminous amount that he has accumulated through the years. I mean, I've heard him, not seen those cards, but
so
I can imagine.
So that's scholarship. I'm sort of an autodidact.
You listen to Forum. We're talking to Peter Coyote. His newest book is The Rain Man's Cure, Third Cure, An Irregular Education. I was looking for the publisher, Peter.
Who is Counterpoint Press.
Counterpoint Press, right. And this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. We're going to go to more of your calls. Let's go next to Mitch in Berkeley. Mitch, you're on.
Hi there. How are you doing, Peter?
Everything I can. Thanks, Mitch.
Hey, first of all, I want to tell you, I think your voice is like butter. I love listening to you, to your work. And I was reading David Talbot's book recently, Season of the Witch.
Yeah.
And I was kind of, he didn't really speak so well in a few places about the Diggers, and particularly about you, and I wanted to give you a chance to say something about that.
Oh, listen, I love David Talbot, and he had a different take. He was not out there on the streets with us, but he's a great-hearted guy, and he told a really good story about San Francisco, and he probably didn't get it all right, and I probably didn't get it all right either. But I'm certainly not picking a fight with a San Francisco stalwart.
And we thank you for the call, Mitch. Let me go right to another. By the way, I should mention that we did an interview with David Talbot on Season of the Witch. It's in our archives. And here's Josh. Josh, you're on.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to thank you, Peter Coyote, for all your work that contributes to Native American and indigenous knowledge. For example, In the Light of Reverence, I just love that documentary, and I met you once outside of a cafe in Sausalito, and you were just really generous and very humble, and I just really appreciated that. I'm part Native American and Jewish myself, and I teach at Dominican University, but I just wanted to thank you.
What do you teach?
I teach history, indigenous studies, cultural studies, whatever I can get my hands on.
Well, you know, I'm not at all Native American. I don't have any Native blood. And in the 60s, I had to fight a couple times with people who, Native guys, who thought that I had appropriated Coyote as a kind of Native identity. And, I'm a Jew with an animal name. I just happened to get my name the same way their grandfather did, through an honest vision. And I just respect them as the encyclopedias of the oldest wisdom of how to live on this culture, on this continent. And I have a lot of Native friends, and I've been involved in a lot of Native issues because they're still getting the short end of the stick, and it just rubs me the wrong way.
We thank you, Josh, for your call. I want to go to a couple of emails here. Kathleen writes, I deeply appreciate Peter's engaged Buddhism and would like to add one small item to his list regarding materialism. In addition to looking at our acquisitional habits and buying less, I suggested boycotting products made by those who use their billions to keep us locked into their agendas as an essential tool. For me, goodbye to Charmin, Vanity Fair, nice paper napkins, and yes, even good old Dixie cups, not to speak of any food products whose manufacturers fight against our right to know what's in what we're eating.
Well, good for her. I mean, those are useful lists, and a number of those I hadn't even thought of as purchases, you know, but she's right.
And here's Nancy writes, I'm curious about Zen people wearing robes. It seems that it sets you apart, just what you said you didn't want to do.
Well, it depends when you wear the robes. Catholic priests wear robes. Anglicans wear robes. When you're fulfilling a ceremonial function, the robe does set you apart. You're holding the room. You're representing a certain role in a ceremony. And a ceremony has to work a certain way to be successful. I don't wear robes in the streets. When I'm in the monastery, I wear robes because they're comfortable and they're easy to sit cross-legged in. And, you know, they don't bind you at all.
Some of the things you do are very uncomfortable, though. I mean, in terms of practice and meditation, as you write about.
Well, yeah, especially, I mean, it's hard to discipline yourself to sit still. But Suzuki Roshi pointed out that, you know, even having difficulty can be a source of pleasure. And I always try to remind people when they're feeling overwhelmed by suffering, they wouldn't be suffering if they weren't alive. And nothing trumps being alive. And I'm sure if I was laying in a ditch with my face half submerged in water with bullets whizzing over my head, I would still rather be alive than not.
And we'll bring another caller on with us. And Sylvia, that's you. Thank you for waiting. Join us.
Yes, good morning, and thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to comment that I personally witnessed Peter Coyote's non-dualistic and non-judgmental values in action. I work for Chevron and in an industry that people love to demonize. While in Aspen, I bumped into Peter, and when I told him I work for Chevron, he had a lot of good things to say about the people and the good things that we do, and so I appreciated his compassion. My question to Peter is, you know, if Wall Street demands quarterly and long-term profits, how could the leaders of our industry tackle some of our most critical challenges of our time, like climate change?
Okay, we only got seconds left. But
they can't. You're exactly right.
And thank you for the call. A man who has compassion not only for Native Americans, but for Chevron executives. Peter, good to have you with us. Thank you.
She wasn't an executive. Thank you, man.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation.